I would like to welcome you all very, very warmly to this session. And I'm glad that this session is still quite full, given it's so late in the day. And I'm happy about that, because I know it will be a very, very interesting and stimulating session. So why will that be? First of all, because we have some excellent contributors with really thought-provoking, stimulating presentations, and also later in the panel. And also because the issue is an issue that is of such high relevance. It touches on so many aspects of our daily lives and on so many really, really important policy areas. So this session is brought to you, it's a joint effort by the Hungarian Academy of Sciences, the Department for Science and Technology of the Republic of South Africa, and ESSEC, the European Academy Science Advisory Council. My name is Christiane Diehl, I'm the Executive Director of ESSEC, and I will be the moderator of this session. Please allow me just to say a few words about ESSEC before we start. ESSEC is the network of the National Academies of Science of the EU member states, Norway and Switzerland. And ESSEC has a particular focus, namely on providing science-based advice to policy and society. So to society, we try to reach out through the media. To policymakers, we try to reach out in direct contact, mostly in Brussels. ESSEC has three programs, our core programs. We mostly work in the areas of environment, energy, and biosciences. And biosciences is very broad. It covers agriculture and also public health. And one of the most brilliant projects we've done in the biosciences program was on food and nutrition security and agriculture. And quite a bit of that work that ESSEC has done together in the Global Network of Science Academies, which is IAP, the Inter-Academy Partnership, a lot of that work will be the content of the discussion today. So just to flag this up, so this was the regional report for Europe, and there were three other regional reports from Asia, Africa, and North and South America. So it was a global effort of the Science Academies, and this has fed into today's session. Please allow me a final remark before I will hand over to Professor Balázs. You know that the motto of this World Science Forum here 2019 is science, ethics, and responsibility. And I think when the European Science Academies joined forces in 2001 and founded ESSEC, they were very much motivated in an ethical sense and wanted to take on their responsibility as scientists for society. So they joined forces and tried to create a vehicle that would allow the science academies to make their repository of understanding and scientific knowledge useful for society. So I think in this way, all of what we're doing here is very strongly connected to this brilliant motto of the World Science Forum. So let me quickly talk you through what we're going to do in the next hour and a half or hour and 20 minutes. We will hear some introductory remarks by Professor Balázs, the General Director of the Center for Agricultural Research in Marton-Vajda. Then we'll have three speakers. It's Cheryl Hendricks, the Head of Department of Agricultural Economics at the University of Pretoria in South Africa, Professor Paolo Attascio, Professor in the Department of Environmental Physics at the University of São Paulo, and Professor Joseph Popp. He's a member of the Hungarian Academy of Sciences, and he's a professor and dean of the Faculty of Economics and Social Sciences in Szent István University in Gödöllő, so not far from here. And we will, at the panel discussion, so all the three speakers will try to join the panel discussion. Probably Professor Attascio will have to leave a bit early, but we'll have the speakers, and then Professor Balázs, and also Dr. Robin Fierce, who is the Biosciences Program Director of ESSEC, then join us for the panel discussion. And we very much want to encourage you. We've left quite a lot of time for discussion, at least 30 minutes. We try to possibly have 35 minutes if we cut the questions among the panel members short. And I hope we will have a very lively and fruitful discussion. So thank you very much. And I would ask Professor Balázs to give us some introductory remarks.
Thank you, Christian. Okay. I think I can talk. Ladies and gentlemen, it is a great pleasure for me to set the scene for this session, thematic session, when we thought to organize this sustainable agriculture, we thought that this will be a very important subject because we are responsible for the future. And along with our special guest this year, South Africa, Cheryl Hendricks and the Department of Technology in South Africa, we negotiated what would be the best subject to deal with. And this was the decision to talk and discuss the sustainable agriculture. This is a statement, but I think it's maybe better to put a question mark afterwards whether we can reach sustainable agriculture. Why I'm saying this? Because the globe is a closed circuit, a compartment, where the water is evaporating, going up, and fell somewhere else, not maybe on that area where evaporated. So the per capita water is never will increase, and of course, due to the extreme high development of the human mankind and the population growth, this means the per capita water is less and less. And this is a key element for agriculture. If you think that you are exporting corn, 1 kilogram of corn need for producing dry weight, 1 kilogram corn need 340 liter of water. So you are exporting water if you are exporting corn. You shouldn't forget this very important agriculture point of the whole agriculture production system. The other key problem is that the agriculture land, the arable land of the globe is extremely fast shrinking. The surface of the globe, less than 4% of the surface is arable land. And this is the area where we should produce enough quantity and good quality of food for the whole population. And this is really a challenge for having a good, sustainable agriculture. And I think from the lectures which we will have here, we may have a better chance to understand what we should achieve in the near future to solve this controversial situation. Thank you.
Thank you and good evening. Following on from that wonderful introduction, I have the privilege of being able to present some of the insights from the IAP report, looking at the global synthesis as well as then focusing perhaps on Africa, which is one of the places that many countries in the world are turning to provide food for the future. So it's not just about producing food for Africa, but also Africa as a destination for many other countries to be producing food. So as Christiane has presented, we had 4 reports across 4 regions, which came up with a myriad of challenges and many opportunities on the causes and the solutions of trying to provide sustainable food supply and looking at both the supply and the demand side of the question and what drives this. So we presented in these reports a set of priorities for generating and using knowledge as a resource to support scientific research and technology innovation to inform and to shape policy choices. What I won't have time to go into, but that was critical, was the need for continuously building the capacity to be able to do this, particularly capacity that's well grounded in the issues of the time and what are the contextual and contemporary issues that we need to deal with. So some examples that we dealt with in this complexity relate to the regional differences and the commonalities across the 4 regions of the world. So the regions differ very much in terms of productivity and the access of farmers to knowledge and services, but also the context for food security and nutrition is quite different. The scientific infrastructure and research capabilities are different and have had different histories of development. And there's also quite a different difference in terms of the level of governance, so whether it's controlled nationally or whether it's more disaggregated at more refined levels. Of course, more regionalized decision making accounts for greater uncertainty and greater contextualization of the research system. But we also see that there are many common elements, including a fragmentation of the research system and disconnects between what policy says, what demand is driving, and what the system is supplying, as well as the fact that very often researchers work independently of policy sector in this area. So the reports cover many of the approaches needed to dealing with the food system and the complexities of the food system and looking at the food system in transition. And we see from this, to our surprise when we came to doing the global report, is that there's quite a lot of similarity across the regions. Diets are generally getting more energy dense. They're becoming more cosmopolitan or international, so people demanding foods out of season, foods that weren't traditionally grown in those areas. And many of these energy dense foods in particular are micronutrient deficient. And so this creates many challenges in the food system. How do we respond to globalization, but also look at what we can benefit from the context and the region? Conflict and climate change came out as common themes as well as the growing populations, urbanization, and environmental change, as well as the issues of food waste and how this is dealt with. So the globalization of diets creates many opportunities and also many challenges for the global food system. And how we deal with this is how the research system will need to respond in order to cope. So in the past, we focused our attention on a narrow number of particularly cereal crops. But as climate change challenges our knowledge of the systems and as areas of suitability change, we're going to have to look more closely at how we develop crops and which crops we should be developing, particularly looking at how we make them more affordable and how in the food system as a whole we can reduce the waste and losses. So the reports looked at understanding the complexities and interrelationships of agriculture and these food systems. And I will explain a little bit about the African report in order to give some illustrative examples. So we also looked in the African report in particular on the influence of these changes on livelihoods and diets of households, and particularly identified the most vulnerable people who are likely to need support and assistance. Why the African context? Well, focusing on the African context has many lessons for the rest of the world, because although Africa has made significant progress in reducing hunger and malnutrition since the Millennium Development Goal era, there's a fragile state of food security, and you will be well aware of many of the crises that we faced relating to political unrest, to conflicts, to migration, to disasters such as the cyclones and many of the more frequent weather events. So this coexistence of too much rain and too little rain, so drought and floods and people having to deal with the extremes of these, and often very quickly followed on. So the El Nino systems that used to, on average, take 7 years to cycle, we now see, particularly in East Africa, successive years of El Nino, La Nino, El Nino, La Nino, and so we don't really know how to deal with these components. So just briefly to cover three of the components of the report and look at the opportunities. The first one is how to improve agriculture and food system efficiency. And this deals with quality and the sustainable supply of seeds and vegetative propagation materials. So not just focusing on seed distribution, but rapidly jumping into the propagation by providing ready planting materials. Looking at orphan crops and wild populations and what particular characteristics do these have for drought, for example, for saline soils. We can learn a great deal from these, but many of these orphan crops have not been domesticated, and so we sometimes don't have the technologies to process them, to preserve them. We also in the report look very closely at the efficiency of livestock and aquaculture rearing as possibilities for improving particularly child malnutrition in Africa. Livestock products being one of the quickest ways of improving child malnutrition, and fish being one of the most efficient converters of feed into protein in particular. But there are many appropriate modern technologies, biotechnologies and biosciences that can help to leapfrog these technologies in Africa and can help to manage many of these biotic and abiotic factors that constrain production and that are under stress. So these modern breeding technologies could help, particularly with domestication of many of these crops and the underutilized foods that we have, that have rich diversity, preserving the biodiversity, but also diversifying diets and providing the necessary protein and micronutrients. But many of these elements are affected by inequalities and unequal access to information, unequal access to inputs, unequal access to development opportunities, and unequal access to market opportunities, although digitization is bridging this gap. One of the other components that was common in all the reports was looking at the resilience and fragility of the food system, and trying in Africa in particular, looking at how to improve mixed farming systems for greater productivity. Also, how do we include farmers in a two-way conversation around learning from farmers and from passing information back to farmers as to how we can improve the resilience of farming systems. So components around soil and water mapping, for example, can be, you can use crowdsourcing in order to allow this to happen and to help us to get a better understanding, particularly of the context, but also of the changing situation and putting knowledge into the hands of farmers. One of the key components of all of the reports is around food safety and waste reduction. In Africa, one of the major components is around refrigeration and storage capacity. So many of the most nutritious foods that are available are highly perishable. They're destroyed in transportation, micronutrients evaporate or are destroyed in processing, or there's just simply a seasonal abundance of things like mangoes, which are highly, which are loaded with vitamin A, but nobody can eat all of them in one go, and then there's no way of preserving them. So how do we get these things moving? But we know that energy supply in Africa is a major challenge, as well as the transport routes. And so there are many, many ways in which we could help improve the system and keep nutrients in the system through improving that. Many African countries don't have food regulations and standards or the capacity to apply them and implement and monitor them. But these are crucial, not only for the knowledge of the consumer to know what they're eating, but also for maintaining the safety safety levels of these foods. One of the other components the report looks at is harmful use of agrochemicals, particularly the overuse of agrochemicals in many of these systems, and how this can be reduced and how farming systems can help to manage this. So putting digitized information about these components into the hands of farmers is a very important part of managing the situation and managing the future. There's also a great deal of concern around aflatoxin, but microtoxins in, as well in Africa, and what systems we can use to control those. Again, many indigenous technologies have managed these systems for a long time, and what can we learn from those systems and help to bridge the gap between the technologies? So one of the discussions in the report is how we can put more tools in the hands of farmers that are cheap technologies that can be rapidly rolled out and that allow on-farm detection of these components before these aggregation of products and the spoilage of much larger quantities of food. So building the capacity to test and certify these products is very important. And again, digital opportunities provide platforms for us to do this and for farmers to share knowledge. Stepping up the enforcement of minimum standards of qualities in food doesn't only have an impact on the livelihoods of farmers, but also their market opportunities and the possibilities of participating in markets. So these are essential not just for safety, but also for improving the livelihoods of farmers. So that just gives you a very brief overview of some of the possibilities of how we can improve the sustainability of the system. Of course, there are many, many more examples in the reports, especially if you take the collection of the four reports, but it will just give you an idea of some of the components that are considered for us to think about. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Cheryl. Thank you. So now we have Professor Paola Tascio. Oops, sorry. Just a second. Oh, no, sorry. Which one was it?
No, it's on the desk.
Sorry.
Close the desk.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Okay, hello to everybody. I am bringing a very easy question to answer to by all of you. So how to feed 10 billion people and keep global warming temperature below 2 degrees Celsius? That is the task, actually, humanity have for the next 30 or 40 years. And as you can imagine, that's not a very easy task. So how to frame this critical questions? First, it's obvious that we are having an acceleration of the climate change issue. You can see this everywhere, not just by Greta going to the streets, protesting, you know, that we don't do anything on climate change, but you can observe, you know, sea level rise, increasing temperature, and so on and so on. So basically, and now we have a climate emergency, like many have changed the language. And the question is, how does this impact on food production according to IPCC and all the new reports on this issue? First, it's important to characterize what's happening with the temperature, you know? So this is the latest 1.5 degrees report from IPCC. So you see that the average temperature is 1.1 degrees, but average is nothing on such a complex planet. You see that northeast part of Brazil already heated up by 2.5 degrees. You see that the Arctic and Siberia is well above 3 degrees. So average does not play a role here. It's very important for us to take in one important issue into account. Continents heat up at least 0.5 degrees more than the global average because of the ocean heating capacity, okay? So when you talk about Paris Agreement to keep temperature of 1.5 degrees, bye-bye, because we already get that in continental areas. So that's a very important concept that not everybody have actually realized, you know? So this is this IPCC special report on climate change and land that was released about 3 months ago. So the global average temperature in black is 1.1 degrees, and in red is temperature in continental areas. We already hit 1.5 degrees. So that is the reality. So we have to stop talking on how to limit increasing temperature 1.5 degrees because you are already there, where we live. So basically, that's a very important message that you have to bring to the general public. What about the emissions of greenhouse gases? They are continuing to increase. Besides Paris Agreement, besides 25 COPs, you know, the increase in 2018 was 2.7% in one single year, and 2019, the increase will be 2.4%. So instead of decreasing emissions, we are still increasing, and we are emitting right now about 38, 39 gigatons of CO2 per year into the atmosphere. So that's another important concept. So what we can expect in terms of increasing temperature? Basically, according to three scenarios, you see Latin America, for instance, on the optimistic average scenario, increase in temperature in central Brazil of about 4 degrees, 4.5. You see in Africa is more or less the same with Australia. So basically what we're talking about is not to keep temperature in 1.5 degrees, but let's hope that the temperature does not increase much more above 4, 4.5 degrees. That's exactly what science says today, with very clear message from many, many models, CMIP-6 simulations that will be released next year by IPCC will say a very similar picture. So this is actually reality. How does this impact on food production? This is a World Economic Forum report released last year. So basically, this is how climate change is projected to have impacts on crop yields. Look for the tropical areas. Look for Brazil. A decreasing yield of about 30, 40%. So that's a very important aspect. And you see that the decreasing yields in agricultural production is all over the tropical areas. The only areas that you gain some possibility to increase agricultural production is, of course, the northern hemisphere temperate regions like Canada, Siberia, eventually Norway, Sweden, and so on. So they actually profit in terms of agricultural output compared to tropical areas. And basically, you see that this will certainly increase our inequality. That's already a very, very important issue, like was discussed today. So the only instrument we have right now to control emissions is Paris Agreement, like everybody knows. And if all INDCs from all countries, including Brazil, United States, Europe, and so on, are fulfilled, the temperature will increase by 3.3 degrees. So that is, again, reality. But we know that Brazil, with an increase of 37% in deforestation this year, will not fulfill its obligation, the same with the United States and the same with many other countries. So 3.3 degrees from the Paris Agreement is a very optimistic view. And 3.3 is an average temperature. Remember that continental areas heats up more than the average by 0.5 to 1 degrees. So we are talking on the optimistic framework of an increase of 4 to 4.5 degrees. Okay, IPCC got the task of, UNFCC asked IPCC, how can we limit the temperature increase to 1.5 degrees? And IPCC gave the answer. Starting 2020, you have to reduce emission by 3 to 5% per year and get net zero emission by 2050. Okay? That's the clear message. And after 2050, until the end of the century, you have to sequester 10 to 20 gigatons of CO2 per year from the atmosphere using technology that we don't actually know very much how we can do that. Okay, but there is a trick on this plot. Where is agriculture? How can we get net zero emission by 2050? We have to eat. How the agricultural emissions fits on this frame, okay? And for that, this is a new report just issued by Food and Agriculture Administration that now puts the fossil fuel together with methane from agriculture, N2O from agriculture, and CO2 from food production. then you see that to reach zero emissions in 2050 is almost an impossible task, whatever we do. Okay? It's very, very easy to see that. Or you have to make a strong agricultural transition from net source to net sink of greenhouse gas emissions using technology that we actually don't know very much about it. Okay, for that, IPCC released this climate change and land report that is basically focused on four main points. It's 1,800 pages with four points. The first one, we need to reduce deforestation now. And you see that from Brazil, Indonesia, and Congo, we are not actually doing that. We are increasing emissions. We need to quickly invest in reforestation and afforestation, because there is only one physical process that removes CO2 from the atmosphere in an efficient way, and this process is photosynthesis. It's the only way to remove CO2 from the atmosphere right now in the amounts and in the scale that needs to be done. Thirdly, in the IPCC report, we need to produce food for 10 billion people in 2050. And four, we need sustainable bioenergy to make a decarbonization of the fossil fuel emissions. So you see that these four aspects are not very easy to make a compromise between them. And then the report also calls the attention that agriculture right now is responsible for 37% of greenhouse gas emissions. It's about 20% of CO2. The rest is methane and N2O. So remember this number, it's 37%. And this will certainly increase, as you can imagine. Right now, we are 7.7 billion people. We'll be 10 billion people in just 30 years from now. So how to make compromises between all these things? So this is a report from the Lancet magazine just last month that shows now, you know, how the emissions from the several agricultural sectors make up the agricultural emissions. You see that 33% is actually meat production, and 9% marine management, energy in the agricultural sector is 22%, methane from rice 16%, and soil fertilization is 13%. We don't have too much space to reduce these emissions with the technology we have right now, unless we start inventing new plants that could do photosynthesis much more efficiently, you know, using CRISP technology. Brazil is doing that. Research on that. China is doing research on that, but that is in the future. So, and then this is the proportion of, from the emissions. And then the question on how to feed 10 billion people is called the food production gap. So basically on the plot on the right, you see that you have a gap of 56% in 2050 to compared to right now. So that is a gap that will not be easy, because as you know, many people in Africa does not have access to high protein diets, for instance, the same in Latin America, the same in developing countries. And as soon as their income increase a little bit, no question about, they will start to eat meat, like everybody have done in the past. And the emission, this translated to the emission mitigation gap, is minus 92%. It's a task that is order of magnitude more difficult than to reduce fossil fuel emissions. So this needs to be on the agenda right now. Otherwise, in 2050, we'll really have serious difficulty. So basically, this report mentioning that emissions in 2050 will have to be at least 70% of the total emission will be attributable to the agricultural sector. And that's a huge fraction. Agriculture will change what energy does right now if you are successful to get rid of fossil fuel in the energy generation sector. So think about that, the importance of agriculture in 30 years from now. And that is really a pretty conservative issue. But to increase production, you need two things. First, where are we going to plant these new crops, you know? So this is, right now, 37% of Earth's land mass is used for food production. If you exclude deserts, if you exclude the Greenland and so on, 50% of the land right now is already used to produce food. You cannot increase that too much. Basically, you need to have tremendous need for improved productivity. And the second, and my final slide, the second problem is water. Where we are going to have water for all these agricultural expenses, you know? So right now, this is the fresh water used for agricultural, industrial, and domestic. You see that fresh water consumption by agriculture is about 92% of all used water in the planet. It's a huge fraction, and water will be the limiting factor for many things in the future. But look here, how the different food, different agricultural products differ in freshwater requirements. For beef is the last here, the last bar. It's 20 times more than maize or other crops. So we have to change diets, no question about. We can do that, but we cannot do miracles with that. So basically, that is the idea I want to bring here for discussion. I think it's very obvious that climate change needs to be on this agenda if you want to build up a sustainable world in 2050.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Paulo, for clarifying. So Paulo really has to go. He's very, very sorry. So we will have to take your thoughts, your input for the panel discussion. But thank you very much for clarifying this important nexus that the agricultural system contributes so much to greenhouse gas emissions, yet is also damaged by the effects very severely. So yeah, it's both on cause and effect, or suffering from the effect. Thank you, and all the best. Thank you. Okay, can I finally ask Professor Popp to make his contribution to our session. Very much looking forward to it. And I think there's a very good connection also from the last, from the water comments given by Paolo. Thank you very much.
So ladies and gentlemen, I feel honored to be here today and give you a presentation on achieving food, energy, and environmental security. This presentation is based on the IASAC policy report on opportunities and challenges for research on food and nutrition security. The brief outline, the global challenge, food, energy security, climate change, sustainable intensification, and conclusions. What are the main challenges? We have an increased demand for food, energy, and water. Increased demand for food 60% by 2050, for energy and water 35% by 2050. Key questions: can we provide enough food, water, and energy to supply a growing population? And can we mitigate and adapt to climate change? And can we at the same time preserve biodiversity and ecosystems? This situation was called the perfect storm by Professor Beddington several years ago. Food security. Main challenge: global population growth coupled with changes in diet. Between 2020 and 2050, the global population will increase by 25%. Demand for food will increase by 60%. And we have to use less water, less energy, less chemicals per unit production. Due to the inefficient conversion of calories of feeds, meat production takes 6 times more land to make the same amount of calories or energies than cereal production. So changing diet will have a large impact on land use, in favor of feed production, and that's the reason that livestock uses 66% of EU cropland. What about the biocapacity? You can see the surface of our planet. 71% is covered by ocean, 11% by unproductive land, and just 18% by productive land. That's a total of 9 billion hectares. So we have 4 billion hectares forest, 3.4 billion hectares pasture or grassland, and just 1.5 billion hectares cropland, where 95% of our food is produced. Productive land is limited and multifunctional. What about the world population growth? We have just one country in the world, China, which has introduced the birth control 30 years ago with a model, one child per family. This model was changed 3 years ago to two children per family. When Jesus Christ was born, 100 million people lived on Earth. By 1960, this number increased to 3 billion. Today, we have 7.7 billion people. And by 2040, global population will reach 9 billion people for sure, because the population growth rate has not slowed down in the past decade and is still 1.1% per year. After 2050, the population growth rate will go down to 0.2%, but it's still very high. Changing diet will have a larger impact on land use than population growth. More and more people can afford eating and buying high value added products like meat and dairy. 1.3 billion people suffer from eating too much. On the other side, 0.8 billion people suffer from malnutrition and hunger. The food is cheap for rich households, where 15% of household income is spent on food. It's very expensive for poor households, with spending 60% of household income on food. Obesity. 33% of global population is overweight. Out of this, 30% obese. As mentioned before, 800 million people are undernourished due to calorie or energy deficit, plus 2 billion people are undernourished due to micronutrient deficit. A child or adult can be malnourished by being undernourished or overnourished. We can see that food prices became relatively stable after the oil crisis in 1973 and 79, but we can see a sharp rise in 2007 and 2011, leading to food riots in North Africa. And after 2011, food prices have decreased because supply is higher than demand. What about food loss and food waste worldwide? Food loss depends on technology. Food waste depends on consumers' behavior. That's the plate waste or consumer waste. In developing regions, food loss and food waste is lower than in developed regions. Energy and nutrient loss and waste should be measured instead of volume or quantity. Evidence-based data of food waste and loss is weak. We do not have exact figures globally. We just have regional surveys done by NGOs generally. That's, for example, a regional survey. You must know this picture saying, that a third of the food we buy in the UK ends up being thrown away. That's not the UK, that's a small region in the UK. And that survey was done by an NGO. We can see the food loss and food waste along the food chain. And keep in mind that food chain losses is at the same time energy and water losses as well. And the loss and waste may go up to 60-70%, including field losses due pests and diseases, because that's just 30% field losses. Energy security. Until the late 17th century, energy consumption was based on biomass energy. After the Industrial Revolution, steam engine and electricity, coal reached a 50% share in energy use by the beginning of the 20th century. And with the introduction of the internal combustion engine, demand for fossil fuels increased fast. Today, in the global final energy consumption, the share of fossil fuels is 80%, the share of renewable energy 18%, and the share of nuclear power 2%. The relative contribution from renewables has increased from 13 to 18% in the past 40 years. It is not a very sharp increase, but the share of traditional biomass has decreased and the use of the modern biomass has increased. Traditional biomass is used for cooking and space heating today, as it was used 12,000 years ago for cooking and space heating as well. The big challenge is the traffic sector. Why? Because the transport sector has a 33% share in total final energy consumption, and the transport sector uses more than 50% of oil. 69% of vehicles are dependent on petroleum, on gasoline and diesel, 3% on biofuels. It's a very small share, and just 1% on electricity. Out of this, just 0.3% on renewable electricity. And number of cars will increase from 1.3 to 2 billion by 2035 in 15 years. Liquid biofuels for transport are generating the most attention. Although only a small fraction of biomass is used globally for biofuels production, the proportion of global cropland used for biofuels is just 2%. However, for some crops, biofuel demand accounts for a significant share of total demand. 20% of global sugarcane, 12% of vegetable oil, and 10% of coarse grains production is used to produce ethanol and biodiesel. The EU and US have introduced caps on food-based biofuels. The development of biofuels production based on non-agricultural feedstock progresses slowly. Next-generation biofuels reduce greenhouse gases further, but plant biomass is low density, low value, bulky material. Transporting and storage large quantities over long distances is expensive. The next part, environmental security. We have reached a crossroad. We can make a right to the direction of a low carbon future. We can make a left to the direction of increasing dependency of fossil fuels. As mentioned in the previous presentation, CO2 emissions reached 37 billion tons last year, and about 90% of CO2 emissions are energy related. We can see a sharp increase of the price of CO2 emissions in the last 2 years in the EU emissions trading system. The price went up from 6 euro per metric ton to 26 euro per metric ton. We have today 46 countries with the carbon pricing systems in place covering over 20% of annual greenhouse gas emissions. I would say just 20%. And Germany has introduced the climate change package 2 weeks ago, and the carbon pricing reform includes a price on CO2 emissions in sectors not covered by the EU emissions trading system, such as transport and buildings. It may serve as a model for other member states in the EU, hopefully. Water bubble is unsustainable and fragile. 7.7 billion people today have to share the same quantity as the 300 million global inhabitants of Roman times. About 78% of water for food comes directly from rain, and the rest is met by irrigation. A quarter of the world's population lives in closed or closing basins. 2 billion people lack access to safely managed drinking water. That's the reason that more and more countries set up water exchanges, and no water left for more development in several rivers. India has a huge problem with the groundwater overdraft because 60% of farmers are dependent on groundwater irrigation. Soil damage, 25% of agricultural land is seriously degraded, and biological productivity is limited by extremes, not by averages, like temperature rise. Green Revolution, you remember that, breeding for more yield while increasing nitrogen and water dependence. And what are the keys to sustainable intensification plan breeding, improving nitrogen efficiency, and decoupling nitrogen to yield dependence? That's the same. And the last slide, extensification is included in agricultural environmental program. What does it mean? Decrease in environmental damage by reducing nitrogen fertilizer, but also decrease in yield. Intensification is the opposite, luxury supply with nitrogen, increasing yield, but strong increase in environmental damage. And sustainable intensification, very efficient use of nitrogen, increase in yield, and decrease in environmental damage. Conclusions, land, energy, and water availability are limited. Existing agriculture areas will be lost to other uses. Soil degradation will continue for many areas. Changing climate will add additional production stress. The Green Revolution demonstrated promises and constraints. Sustainable intensification is an opportunity combined with technology and profitability. And that's the take-home message for you. Thank you very much for your attention.
Will you immediately, why don't you immediately stay here with us? And I'm also asking Cheryl Hendricks to come up and Evan Balazs and Robin Fears to come up to join us for the discussion panel. Right. So before we... Oh, so sorry. Oh, sorry. Yes. So before we open up the floor to the audience, and I would ask all of you already to think of the questions you would like to ask. I mean, I fear this session on sustainable agriculture has been so broad and we've been widening this to sustainable life or sustainable being of human beings on Earth. So I acknowledge it's quite a broad spectrum, but please do start to think of your questions, your specific questions. And you do that whilst I ask the panel here to give any comments that have come up for them. I mean, they're all very experienced in the field, and I can see Professor Balazs already has a comment he wants to make. Please.
Thank you. I'm not so pessimistic in terms of agriculture, sustainable agriculture. We heard that 25% of greenhouse gas emission is produced by the agriculture. I would like to mention one very good example how good agriculture research and science can mitigate this problem. In 1944, where the artificial insemination was introduced as a practice in animal husbandry in the United States, in those days, 26 million Jersey milking cow produced the milk for the United States citizens, and it wasn't enough. So they had to rely on more import. With very good breeding program using this artificial insemination system, they were able to select Jersey cow which are producing much higher amount of milk. Today, there are only 9 million Jersey cow who are producing the amount what they produced in 1944, which means that three times less animal are producing the same amount of milk what the American population need, which means that at least 3/3 of the CO2 emission and methane emission is really achieved. That this is very important that we can reduce this, and not talking about the manure which they are producing, and also the animal feed is not needed as much because there is only 9 million produce this. So if agriculture research getting a good support can solve the problem or mitigate at least in this area.
I really like this starting point for our discussion because I felt perhaps there was a bit too much doom and gloom here in the room. So this is good to point out the opportunities of agricultural biotechnology and husbandry biotechnology. So any more comments to one another? Please feel free. Switch it on first.
I remember the slide showing that 1.3 billion people are suffering from eating too much, and on the other side, 0.8 billion people are suffering from malnutrition and hunger. That's because household income difference is much more larger in the world than the price difference of food. That's the major issue. The price difference of food is not that high, but the difference of household income is very high, and that's the reason that you have countries in Asia, Africa, where up to 80% of household income is spent on food, and that's the reason of malnutrition and hunger.
That reminds me of something that Cheryl Hendricks just said. The reason for hunger is not the distribution of food, but the distribution of cash. So, Cheryl, mm-hmm. do you want to add a comment to this?
Sure, and livelihoods and the capacity of people to generate income and to find sustainable livelihoods, to diversify livelihoods, particularly in the face of change as well. Yeah, but listening to the doom and gloom makes me more excited about the reports that we produced, because I think they do try to change the narrative from what are the causes to more what are the solutions, and identifying the technologies and what is available to provide those solutions, I think, is something that we don't see that often in the world. A lot of research focuses on the causes.
Thanks. And not the solutions. Given that Robin Fierce had such a crucial role in producing those reports, perhaps let's give Robin a chance to comment and then we will open the floor for discussion.
Thank you. My main task comes a little bit later this afternoon when Christiana has asked me to summarise some of the conclusions, and I think you can all sympathise, that's quite a large task. But I did want to emphasise the point that you introduced and Cheryl and Irvin reinforced. We've heard a lot about the challenges this afternoon, but there are opportunities, and as a major part of seizing those opportunities, we have science, and science is a global public good. The academies have a very important role in demonstrating how science can help inform policy, can provide resource for innovation, can steer practice That's a continuing responsibility, of course, for the academies and others in the scientific community. And as you've seen, I think one of the strengths of the innovative project that IAP designed in an inter-regional format is we were able to bring the analysis, the synthesis, and some of the strong messages to link local, regional, and global, to share good practice, to inform policy making, and so on. I won't say anything more now.
Right. So you've heard, like, connected to the ethics and the responsibility of the scientists, they have defined a number of approaches and opportunities that come from science to making the food system and agriculture more sustainable. Please, may I invite your questions? Already there's a lady there raising her arm and a gentleman exact opposite and two more. So we've got four questions. Should we take one round? We'll take those four questions and then we do a second round. Please.
And we don't know the impact that this is going to maybe have in the environment. So
yeah, you're pointing to a very important area. Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. Let's take it this way. Oh, had you raised your hand before? I think we had four questions. Let's take the first round first. This gentleman there, one gentleman was there. Oh, the lady, sorry, and the gentleman there. Second round.
That the transport-intensive, export-oriented agriculture can be maintained in the future if we really want to achieve sustainability?
Okay, the lady over there.
Thank you. I have three very brief questions.
Okay, yeah.
Number one, through Dr. Schirer, you did touch on many things, but I just would like to understand your views on organic farming versus sustainable agriculture. That is one. The second question, any one of the panel members can respond. We were talking about the contribution of this agriculture sector to greenhouse gas emission, and in fact, rice, somebody did highlight that it is one of the main contributors to greenhouse gas emission. For that, what I have understood is that there are some countries who are producing more than what is required, and they are still continuing to produce. There are some countries whose sufficiency is less than 30%, 40%, and that is where we work in silos. And it's quite pleasing to hear that with innovation, I mean, we can overcome a number of challenges. So probably some understanding or some statement on this with regard to rice, similarly with regard to meat production. The third one is for water. Water security, water challenges, which is being faced everywhere. But what I feel is, if you look at the global level, probably the water availability, per capita availability, may not be that bad. But what is lacking is the efficient utilization of water. Probably we are not investing enough to look into that aspect. So probably some statement on this will be appreciated. Thank you very much.
Thank you for those questions. Quite a lot of questions in this first round. This gentleman there, and then we will give our panel a chance to respond.
Thank you. Of all, I would like to thank the moderator of the session and all speakers and all participants of this important session, Sustainable Agriculture. My name is Zakaria Follett. I am professor in the Agriculture and the Biological Research Division, National Research Center from Egypt. And also, I am coordinator of the Global Alliance for Climate Smart Agriculture. We talk together about how to do to the sustainable agriculture and talk about emissions for the carbon dioxide and other things from the agriculture sector. Actually, should be held for the Global Alliance for Climate Smart Agriculture, because this alliance debated on three pillars. Number one, how to increase the productivity of the food in the agriculture sector, and how to decrease the total emissions about carbon dioxide. And third is how to adaptation and mitigation of the climate change. So I hope to join, because it is very important for the developed and developing countries at the same time to go to the sustainable agriculture. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that question. So we'll start with the first question, and Professor Balázs will respond to the agriculture biotechnology.
Yes. You mentioned the genome or gene editing question. Okay, so the situation is very simple. If you go out in the nature, there are all of the biodiversity is based on different mutant plants. If you go in a canola field, phenotypically, all of the canola are the same. However, genetically, there are a lot of so-called single nucleotide polymorphism. So you can select out even from those mutant, which will be more helpful and useful for the agriculture. Today, we have a technology based on the big data, means that we have a lot of genome sequences, which means that all of the coding sequences of the different plants, animals, and microbes are known. So we can see where are those important genes which are useful for the agriculture or not beneficial for the agriculture. And this new technology, so-called precision breeding or precision mutagenesis, or call it genome editing or gene editing, scientifically, you can turn on and turn off genes. And this is happening in the nature. If you use herbicides regularly, herbicide resistance on the weed will develop quite soon. And this is based on single mutations. And this is what is a natural system. So it's not in terms of nature is not a new thing, but we can use this for our future and for our agriculture.
Yeah, but those are GMOs.
No, we are not considering GMOs. This is the European Court of Justice made a decision, but only the European Court of Justice told that this is considered as GMO. However, several countries, Japan, Canada, Brazil, and the United States, is not considered this technology as GMO, because that's not falls under the GMO regulation in those countries. Europe is at the moment sticking that this they considered legally as GMO. We know that there are a lot of movement in European Union that when the new commission will start to work, they would like to propose to change the GMO definition. Because I would like to remind you, the Cartagena Biosafety Protocol will be 20 years old because it was published and ratified in 2000. And they think that due to the more knowledge which we gained, we can really do a better definition for GMO, which may allow not to consider genome editing falling under the GMO regulation as it is at the moment.
Okay.
You raised a very sensitive question. I give you an example. Our constitution says that each Hungarian citizen has the right to live in a GMO-free world. I wrote some articles about the economics of GMO crops import of soybeans. And I was fired immediately from my research institute as the deputy general director because I heard the constitution. And these articles were published, you know, in books issued in the United States, in Elsevier journals, etc. I went to court, I won the process, I got the salary of 2 years, in total 2 million Hungarian forint net. And I transferred to Debrecen University at that time. It happened in 2012. And I have not returned to this research institute again. If you are fired by the government from a research institute, financed by the government, I don't think there is a need to go back. And that happened in an EU member state, you know. And we have just 5 member states in the EU producing GM crops, not more. But you must know that about 90% of protein feed, soybean, is imported. And 85% of the imported soybean is GM soybean. So what makes the difference? Where can you find a GM-free world? It's not true. It's a lie. You know, even if you read it in the Hungarian constitution, policymakers make the decision in the EU and not science. Not science, absolutely not. Science has nothing to say in this issue. That's my answer, precise answer to your question.
Yeah, can I say that this decision by the European Court of Justice in some way was somewhat legalistic? It was more a definitional decision. And as Professor Balázs said, we all assume that the new commission will be able to create a new policy outlook in this area, though that remains to be seen. This is a very important area. It's a very important part of the opportunities that we see and that were defined in the reports. However, given that we had quite a few other questions, let's first address those, and perhaps in the second round of questions, we will come back to this aspect. So the gentleman was asking about export, food exporting. Has any of you that was able to... You meant like globally exports? You meant like, say, Brazil producing GMO soybeans for Europe for feed for pigs and stuff? So any perspective from you on that?
Well, I prefer if a country is able to produce enough food for the country. So you have to be production self-sufficient, because this is really, you have a chance not to have rely on very expensive and long trade from other countries or even other continent. The irony of European Union is that half of the European Union budget is going to support agriculture. Meantime, almost 60% of the agriculture products are imported from other continent than the European Union. So the question is, why we are supporting so highly European agriculture? But this is the reality. The problem is, again, at least in my mind, that the so-called subsidy on land, this is a real system which makes the market mislead all of the situation. So if you are growing something or not growing, you can get a levy or I don't know an amount to because you are the landowner, and not the people who are really working on agriculture get that. And this is the real problem in the European Union. I can tell you quite easily, in Italy, the Vatican Bank own quite a lot of land in Italy. Santander Bank do the same in Spain. Talking about the French banks, the German banks, the Dutch banks, they are owning the land, so their money is going for the banks and not really the productor. And this is the real problem, which is really make the market absolutely useless in that terms. And this is why we really having problems to import something from other continent.
Can you take that microphone, Robin? Robin wanted to say. Yeah.
Okay, with regard to trade, I mean, I come from a country, the UK, where we import at least 50% of our food. the specific UK problems, of course, will be accentuated very shortly following Brexit, but not going to get into that this afternoon. But the point I want to make about many countries in Europe importing large amounts of their food from the rest of the world is that we are exporting our lack of sustainability to those other countries. So we have an impact on the use of water, soil, energy in other countries. So there is an issue there for equitable sustainability around the world in consequence of what we're doing in Europe. But more generally, we cover several of the trade issues in our global FNSA report. I think, you know, our starting point was that global trade is good, but it has to be fair and managed and take account of a number of issues that we describe in detail in the global report.
Okay, and then if Cheryl and Professor Popp could try to focus also on the two other sets of questions we had. Thank you.
Generally, food is consumed where it is produced. 10% of the global food production is traded globally, not more, 10%, but that's the average. You have countries with a self-sufficiency rate of 40%, 180%. The self-sufficiency rate of food in the EU is at the moment 105%. The EU exports more than it imports in value. I am talking about value, not volume. Value. The main issue in Europe is that mainly subsidized products are exported. And the major issue is the deficit in protein feed, mainly soybean. The EU imports 33 million metric tons of soybean and soybean meal each year, and produce less than 3 million metric tons of soybean. That's the issue. And we have that crazy GMO issue. And I think we will be dependent on soybean in the next 100 years as well, as we have had in the last 100 years.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Cheryl, it's probably tempting to continue on that with European export of foodstuff to, say, Africa. But if you could try to also address those two other sets of questions. Thank you.
Okay, I think that your question was more comment than a question. So, but on the organics one, I guess it's the flip side of the GMO discussion. So organics is an incredibly laudable principle and something that certainly has value, but it's never going to feed the world. And that's the reality that we have to face. And so although the principles should have practical components that should be integrated as much as possible into production systems, but even organic consumers are particularly fussy about the quality and of the food, so expecting perfect vegetables and fruit when it's not possible to do so in organic systems. So, yeah, on a smaller scale, fantastic, but not at a larger scale. Thanks.
Okay. I've already have seen three gentlemen wanting to ask a question. I want more ladies asking a question. Do you have any more ladies asking a question? Yes, one lady. Can we have another lady asking a question? One more lady with a question? Nah, they're also shy. Okay, I'll call out those four people and perhaps a lady will change her mind. So the first gentleman was here, then it was Volker, then this gentleman over there, the lady there, and another lady? Oh, no. Okay, thank you. Another lady and the gentleman behind her. So please, we will not be able to do more than two rounds of questions. So now we have six people, I think. So please be quite crisp, quite to the point, and we will also have to ask our panel to be quite to the point before we close this. Okay, so the microphone is here. Let's start from right to left with this gentleman and then the lady in front of him.
Like bring your question, like Professor Joseph who was talking about technology in agriculture, like GMOs, like that we have the capacity to increase production and reduce the use of natural resources. I think it's true. I believe in that, and like we cannot feed the world without like.
Okay. What's the question?
I just want to say like we already have the technology and we already produce food for more than 10 million people. So shouldn't we think about like how do we spread the food in the world? I mean like how to bring like enough food for everybody? It's more about ethics.
Yeah,
and
ethics.
Like, I don't know, like, it's
okay. So how to stop hunger in the world? Like this little small question you're posing to our panel. Okay, we'll look at that. So the lady in front of you.
I think transportation is very important and deliver food around the world. I'm Gordana Shurlan Momirovic from University of Belgrade, Faculty of Agriculture, Professor of Genetics. And I'm very interested in editing of genes. Because I think this is a better method than GMO, because we just try to find proper gene and change his function, and after that we can use F1 or another generation to do selection for plant which we want, not off or on plants.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. I think this is very good technique, which is your opinion.
Okay, pass it on to this gentleman who's been very patiently waiting. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Jan Zelev. I am working in the Academy of Agriculture and Forestry Sciences in Romania. And first of all, I wish to congratulate on the panelists' very distinct presentation and concerning the future and the climate change is a very encouraging image we have now. But in this context, my question is, in the last week, it was a big debate in China about the future of the agriculture, of the green agriculture and precision agriculture, and maybe this kind of agriculture and techniques used can be a solution for future. It was my question.
Okay. Thank you very much. I take the mic from you and give it to the lady who was the more courageous of the two. Just a second, Volker.
So I'm Jenny Jones, and my question will be particularly addressed to you. I do understand that agriculture, sustainable agriculture comes through and every part of agriculture culminates together. So you, in your African model, I suppose, did highlight the problems that you're facing, that the distribution channel is a problem there. What are the solutions that you have come up with to cater to the problems?
Thank you. So if you could give it to the gentleman. Yes. Could you pass the mic to this gentleman there, which is the last one?
Thank you. Actually, my question has been asked by many people, but still I have something to present. As the feeding options are decreasing year by year, and as the population is increasing, so GMOs will not play a major role for sustainable agriculture, and because I'm from India, and I can see the feeding options are decreasing year by year. So, I'm taking example of golden rice. So, why we are not allowed to take or use or to feed golden rice as like Philippines and any particular area? Because of and we can see the deficiency of vitamin E in particular region, like in India and in many other developing countries. We can see. So, why we are not allowing? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
User fee.
Very good. Thank you. Many of you will know that golden rice was created like with additional vitamin A to counter vitamin A deficiency and subsequent blindness, and it was for sort of the whole GMO debate, like to shorten it, was never fully rolled out. So I'm asking our panel now to each choose like two questions that they're going to answer, that they're going to respond to. Otherwise, we will never be able to finish this round. So please be succinct and try to give some good response to two of the questions, of the six questions we've heard.
I think I can comment on all of the questions and comment on genome editing, including Volker's question. I think it's quite rapid because in the United States, they already deregulated genome editing crops. So they can get a green light immediately to introduce it to agriculture practice. This is the same in other countries where they have deregulated all of the genome edited plant. And we have very good examples, like we have some bacterial blight resistance rice in China, which can be distributed quite fast. And I think it's we don't need to wait as long as with the classical breeding system, so 5-6 years to get permission. So I'm in that sense very optimistic.
Two questions related to precision agriculture. And I mentioned in my last slide that sustainable intensification cannot be achieved without the application of precision technology. It's interesting that the old generation of farmers are very reluctant to apply the modern technology, including robots and artificial intelligence, but even precision agriculture is not attractive for them, and we don't have a young generation of farmers, or that generation is very narrow. So it's a huge problem. It's a huge problem in the EU. How to accelerate the penetration of precision technology in agriculture? And on the other side, farmers do not like to be called farmers related to agriculture because agriculture is not very attractive for the young generation. But by using precision technology, they may be called, for example, nature engineers and so on, and it may become much more attractive for the young generation than agriculture or food production or food processing.
Thank you for that aspect. I mean, we shouldn't forget social sciences, we're all human beings. I mean, if there are clever ways of nudging people into careers, why not? Why not use them? So please, Cheryl. So, Cheryl, thank you very, very much. I would like to emphasize that our panelists, our contributors, will stick around a little bit after the end of the session. So if you have questions, please feel free to ask them directly also. And very kindly, Robin Fierce had agreed to take on the very difficult task of trying to summarize the session. So I'm inviting now Robin to give us a summary concluding remarks. Thank you, Robin.
Well, in the interests of all us all getting drinks and dinner tonight, you'll be very pleased to hear that I'm not going to attempt to summarise our excellent and very comprehensive presentations or the wide-ranging discussion. And you may or may not be sorry to hear, I'm not going to try and resolve the controversies that know, we've had some very important points raised in discussion. I would just note, really to reinforce the point that Irvin made, that science can be fast. What is slow is policy making and regulation. So in a sense, that's a theme that's permeated all of our discussions. As many of us heard earlier today, in a previous session, academies now have a great opportunity to play their role in progressing the Sustainable Development Goals. We haven't heard too much in this session, but of course a lot of the topics that we've been talking about and actually are reviewed in the IAP reports are very relevant to multiple Sustainable Development Goals and the linkages between them. And that's something we should very strongly bear in mind. It's not just about hunger. There are many other aspects in terms of the complexity between agriculture, energy, water, soil, things you've heard about, the total value chain in food systems. These are complex systems, and the challenges are great. I just want to highlight a couple of points in very briefly. One to emphasise something that's been of particular interest to us in ESAC and IAP over the last few years, and has come up here, that the nexus, the interface between climate change, health and agriculture. So that yes, climate has significant effects on agriculture. We saw earlier the stark description of a world where agricultural productivity will be projected to decline significantly in a lot of the world, may increase in some of the countries of the Northern Hemisphere, including some of our European countries, but that's really only a partial analysis in terms of temperature change. There will be other changes, for example, in water availability that may constrain agriculture in our northern countries. There will certainly be increasing pests and diseases that will reduce agricultural yield. And even if total yield goes up in those countries that are currently rather cold for cereal production, the nutrient composition will decline. And so we have to think about nutrition as well as calories. All of that's by way of saying that tackling the contribution of agriculture to greenhouse gas emissions, however we choose to do that, may also bring co-benefits for health, and we heard some discussion of that. I won't expand on that, but just advertise a session that we have tomorrow morning on climate justice and health that will cover some of these issues in more detail and greater breadth. So you're very welcome tomorrow morning. Mm-hmm. I think in the interest of time, that there's only one other point I will emphasize, and that's the overarching vision of this World Science Forum, science, ethics and responsibility. And responsibility, in order to achieve sustainable agriculture, title of this session, and sustainable societies more broadly, we all have, as scientists, have a responsibility to engage with others, that is the public at large, policymakers, stakeholders. Meetings such as the World Science Forum help to catalyse that discussion within the scientific community and generate the enthusiasm and the motivation to go out and engage with others. But of course, we need to do more, and particularly with some of these troubling issues for sustainable agriculture and the effect of climate, we need to counter misinformation. It's not the case that we can tell the evidence and it's immediately believed, because there's some very loud voices out there saying different things. So we must be prepared to engage and to build our communication on the basis of excellent science. Without that, of course, we don't have a position. So today's session, exemplifying and continuing some of the great interregional work of the Inter-Academy Partnership, demonstrates, I think, one innovative way where we can bring together the evidence, the perspectives, the synthesis from across the world to construct strong messages and to share good practice and debate among ourselves some very difficult issues. And
okay, so I would like to thank you all very warmly for your participation and your excellent questions. And please join me in thanking our panelists and speakers.